LEAD, L-E-A-D, love, effort, attitude, discipline. Looks good on a bumper sticker. I think as a coach, if I show it to parents and say, hey, this is what we're going to do, they're going to say, oh yeah, that sounds great. And a lot of coaches do that, but they miss the practical part of this is how I'm going to try and foster love into our players. You've got a playbook for offense. You've got a playbook for defense. If you're in football, you've got a playbook for special teams. And I think such an error made by well-intended coaches, they say, oh, kids are going to learn about resiliency just by being on the team. Just by being here and around us, they're gonna figure out what discipline is, right? No, I don't think so, especially because not everyone on a football team is on the field at the same time.
Hey folks, welcome back to Throwing Mountains podcast. My name is Mike Hatch, and I am here, of course, with Chris Bollinger. Chris, did you like that intro?
I did, but throwing. My back's hurting right now, so the thought of throwing mountains is making me cringe.
Okay, sorry. All right. Well, this is where men rediscover courageous leadership. You're going to be strengthened from a story today and from all the stories we share of God working in the lives of ordinary men, men who've become leaders in their spheres of influence by relying on God and following Jesus. Today, I'm super excited. We have Levi Nelson with us. And there is, before I bring you in, Levi, I'm going to do a little bit of a proud papa kind of thing. So Levi and his family have been good friends of mine. I think I've known Levi for maybe 30 years or something like that. Levi, when I played high school football, was the water boy on our football team. And man, I will never forget that. And it's amazing that here we are coming back around years later, having you on after you just wrote this book, Levi. I am so excited about this, but let me go into a little bit of background on Levi so folks can understand. And first of all, it's Coach Nelson. He's a coach, without a doubt. And he was a coach even way back when. You talk about a kid that had the most positive attitude growing up. But Coach Nelson holds a doctorate in sport and performance psychology and two master's degrees in sports science and curriculum and instruction. That's physical education, the latter, and the first one, sports science, has to do with coaching. He spent 14 years coaching high school football, 9 as a head coach. He currently serves as a secondary school teacher, college professor, certified trainer in the Positive Coaching Alliance, or PCA, coach developer for USA Hockey, and stadium tour guide at Lambeau Field, where his beloved Green Bay Packers, of course, play. His past professional experience includes time spent with the Cleveland Cavaliers, Cleveland Indians, University of Akron, the athletic department there, and the Walt Disney Company. Coach Nelson earned multiple awards for his leadership abilities and was one of PCA's 50 National Double Goal Coach Award winners in 2018, a national award honoring coaches who strive to win while also pursuing the second more important goal of teaching life lessons through sports. He was also the recipient of the Semper Fi Coach Award, honoring one Ohio high school football coach who had overcome significant obstacles in order to succeed and display faithfulness to the mission of their team and exemplify the Marine standard of excellence in developing leaders. In 2023, Coach Nelson was recognized by the Greater Green Bay Chamber as a distinguished teacher. Coach Nelson and his beautiful, supportive wife, Lindsay, and are parents to Lila and Luke. They reside in Titletown, USA, which is Green Bay, Wisconsin, for those of you who don't know, along with their dog, Nietzsche. Is that how you pronounce it? Nietzsche?
Nitschke. Nitschke.
Nitschke. Nitschke, of course.
Yeah, that okay. Boy.
Levi, you've come a long way since being the water boy of my high school football team, brother.
Mike, getting ready to do this podcast, you think about things, and yeah. It's a circle of life, but when I served as a high school football coach, we would take our varsity team down to the elementary school to read books to the kids and do those things, and I always told our kids, they think you are NFL players. You are as important as the guys playing on Sunday, and you were that to me. I kid you, I have goosebumps right now thinking back to that. But I remember, I was like, oh, that's Mike Hatch, man. That's number 2 for the Red Devils. You were that to me. And it's funny how things go.
I tried to find it, but way back in the day, I know you drew a little, like a cutout football player with number 2 and Hatch on the back. And you gave it to me as a gift. I swear I've got it somewhere. I couldn't find it. I was going to break it out to show you, but yeah, man, this is special. This is a special moment, I think, for both of us. Definitely for me.
Absolutely.
So yeah, man, it's been fun to watch you from afar do all that you've been doing. So let's go ahead and start out as we always do. We're going to start with a fence post story. And for those listeners who have not been with us before, a fence post, just think about a fence that sits along a property, and every vertical post that holds up those horizontal pieces represent significant moments or people in our lives that made us who we are today. And so, Levi, we'd love to hear a little bit of your fence post story. Tell us a little bit about your history and what brought you to where you are now.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike. Not to give too much away from my book, but as a college professor, I got to teach a class called Coaching Football at the University of Akron. Mm. I can't believe I got paid to do that. It was unbelievable. And I also taught a class called Intro to Coaching. And one of my favorite exercises we would start with every year is, who is the best coach you've ever had? Trying to get everyone to think back to their greatest coach. And in my book, I do the same exercise, trying to help whoever's reading the book. And I share that my greatest coach was actually my mother. And the book, again, not to give too much away, but the title is Lead, a Coach's Playbook on How to Positively Impact the World Through Love, Effort, Attitude, and Discipline. So that's the acronym LEAD, Love, Effort, Attitude, and Discipline. And I write in the book, I think one of the greatest things my mother ever did is I never recall her ever sitting me down and saying, okay, it's important to love others and it's important to work really hard and you need to be positive and you should be disciplined. But she just lived it every day, every day of my life. I watched this woman, and I write about this in the book, but she taught me, she was the first person to teach me that it does not matter what your last name is. It doesn't matter where you live, what kind of car you drive. You should treat everyone with respect and dignity. And Mike, we would have meals growing up, family, Thanksgiving dinners, Easters, whatever. And my mother would always invite people who might not have a family to share the holiday with. I didn't think it was ever weird. I didn't think that, but sometimes you wonder why this person's there, whatever. But what an awesome opportunity to have a front row seat of how to love other people, how to show that love. And then I write about effort and attitude. My mother, and I get a lot from her, but I can't ever remember her having less than four or five jobs. She was always doing a million things, cleaning the house. I always joked, I don't think she slept. She just charged herself at her desk yeah. doing things, but worked extremely hard and is the most positive person I think God ever created. She is so positive, and I never heard her complain throughout my life. No matter what was going on, I think one time when I had reached like 20 years old, she sat down and we had a talk and she kind of vented a little. But throughout my whole life, I never heard her complain ever. And if I was ever going through something and I walked in the house and I wanted to feel bad for myself for this or that, she just, instead of, oh, I'm sorry, she just injected so much positivity into the conversation.
Yep.
That I was like, oh, well, I guess I'll, if I want to fit in around my own house, I better be positive here.
I can vouch for that, by the way. Knowing your mom, she is definitely one of the most supportive, encouraging people that I've known. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not afraid to say I'm a mama's boy. And I write in the book that she just modeled this throughout my entire life. So I'm going to put her number one, not to say that other family members didn't influence me or not, but if I had to pick one positive coach, it would be her. And then fast forward, I'm going to tell you about two other people. Once I got to college, I took a general education class. I was going to go into radio and television. I was going to go into mass media broadcasting. I was going to be the next Ron Burgundy and read the news or whatever it was.
That's great. Yes.
And I took a general education class called, I think it was Intro to Coaching, just to, oh, this looks fun. And I'll never forget, this gentleman walked in and I'm like, boom, I want to be him when I grow up. Throw out the 4 years that I had spent taking all these classes. This guy's walking in with the sweatsuit. He's got a little grizzled beard, wearing a visor on his head and just talking about Coach Wooden and Jim Tressel and all these awesome coaches. And I'm like, Yes, I want to be you. So his name was Mike Duve, and I went on to serve as his graduate assistant at the University of Akron for 2 years and then got a second master's there. So I guess actually 3 years, but served as a very big role model for me. Still connect with him to this day. So Dr. Duve was that. But Dr. Duve also, while I was at Akron, and this is why I'm going to heaven, Mike. So I grew up in the church and believed in Jesus and followed him. I'm not sure how close my walk was, how close my relationship was. I feel like others would perceive me as a good guy, a good person, good kid type thing. Went to college and just, I've heard this before, but you kind of fall out of that routine, whether it's going to Young Life or going to church on Sunday or whatnot. Dr. Duve reached out to this huge mega church called The Chapel in Akron, and they have someone whose job is to work in sport ministry. And Dr. Duve said, hey, I want to organize a Bible study. He was like, Levi, would you want to come to this? And yeah, absolutely. I'm all about Jesus. Let's go. And there were four or five in the group to start, people in the athletic department. And very quickly, that number dwindled. And pretty soon, it was just me in the group. The gentleman's name was Dale Saylor, and he is why, Mike, I am going to heaven one day.
Wow.
Dale poured, the cup was overflowing into me for years. Met with me every week. I can't imagine how busy his schedule must be. But I think it was Wednesday at noon or whatever it was, he drove from Wadsworth, Ohio to meet with me one-on-one. And he's one of those guys, you might know this, he always would give me like three books at a time. It was never like, how's that book going? Here's one book I recommend, maybe check it out. He would just come hand me, here are three books. And it's like, okay. Wow. So most of my Christian reading and whatnot came from Dale. But one of the first books we got into was a book called In a Pit with a Lion on a Snowy Day by Mark Batterson. And that was kind of a moment for me where I just decided to quit running from things and attack them head on and really changed my life. I'm wearing a bracelet right now that says Chase the Lion on it. And nice. So again, Dale, he married Lindsay and myself, a dear friend, wonderful person, huge Ohio State Buckeye fan if he ends up watching this. So he'll smile for that. But I owe a ton to Mike Duve, to Dale Saylor, another guy I worked for named Chad Garrity, who just showed me how to treat people. I was an intern in the athletic department, Mike, and we would meet the mayor of Akron or a CEO of a company, and he would always say, hey, have you met Levi? He's doing great things for us. And I'm this 20-year-old intern, like, no, you don't have to introduce me to the mayor or whatever, but worked really hard, treated people well. So those are like the three men when I was at that impressionable age in college who just took me under their wing and invested in me. And I'll never forget when I moved to Green Bay and became a head coach. This might have been when I became a head coach, but Dale, I thanked him for his investment. And he said, I've invested in you. Your job is to go pour into others just as I've poured into you and go invest in those coaches. So no matter where I've been, I've really made an effort to try to help assistant coaches in different ways. But I'll never forget Dale saying that. Your job is essentially go make disciples of others. And man, that guy loves Jesus. And so I owe a lot to all those guys. So those are my fence post moments, Mike. Thanks for asking.
That's amazing. Because almost everybody I think that we've talked to have made a difference big time. Obviously, we have them on this show because of it. But many of them, if not all of them, would point to specific people who really poured into them and invested in them.
Levi, as a coach, you've had the opportunity to impact hundreds or thousands of young people's lives. But when you mention the greatest coach in your life, or just a coach who's had an impact on you, I think about a man named John Street, who was a coach at the University of Akron for women's basketball when I was attending as an undergrad. Obviously, I didn't play women's basketball, so I wasn't under him as a coach. My sister was an assistant under him at the time. She was a grad student and she was an assistant under Street. But Street had such a huge impact on me. I hung around a lot. I covered the women's team for the school newspaper. So I was hanging out with my big sister, who was an assistant coach there. But Street just took an instant interest in me, and he always called me Big Shooter. Just gave me a nickname of Big Shooter, which just filled me with, you know, I didn't play college basketball. I played some high school, but I mostly rode the bench. And he took me to the chapel just off the campus of the University of Akron. But he had so much impact on me looking back because he poured into me when he saw me. Every time I came, he encouraged me. And I just think that all of us in any walk of life, but especially a coach, can have such a huge impact on all the people around us just by having that positive attitude and by being an encourager and taking notice of people who are not on your team, but who are around and just filling us with God's love. I think of Street, Coach John Street, who still coaching. I think he's in his 70s now. He's still coaching somewhere in Ohio, coaching high school, but just such a big influence on me.
Okay, so Levi, you had, I'm sure, a time away in a sense where you weren't prioritizing God in your life in school, right, in college. And praise God for Duve taking you under his wing and pouring into you. But I'm just curious, you've always been to me a guy who seems to have always had at least some kind of sense of morality, where you haven't strayed in some huge sinful way, maybe. Correct me if I'm wrong, if that's true, but do you feel like God had his hand upon you? It seems that way from my perspective, that he almost protected you in certain ways, kept you from going in some dangerous directions. Would you say that's true?
Well, I tell everybody, I was born on second base. I didn't hit a double. I beyond blessed, like can't even count the blessings I have. I always tried to do the right thing. I think I was raised by two great parents. I also, Mike, was pretty lucky that my older brothers were 7 and 8 years older, respectively. And I named my son Luke Andrew after my two brothers because I don't know many brothers who would take on the parental role that they did. They really tried to raise me in a good way. So I guess I have my parents to thank for not only raising me, but for raising my brothers the right way. And they were not too cool to hang out with their little brother who was in middle school. Some of my best memories are me and my middle school friends in the basement playing knee football or whatever with my two older brothers. Yeah. They could have been going to college parties or whatever, but no, they were there. I had such a good example, not just from one or two, but four people growing up. Mm-hmm. I was also really lucky where I grew up, St. Clairsville High School in St. Clairsville, Ohio, a lot of great friends and family. Mm-hmm. But I will say, Mike, that you look back, especially I think in those college age, and you wish you would have stayed on the path more. Well, I think you had a great line there where you said, I didn't prioritize Christ. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I went through 3 or 4 years where I still had high morals or whatnot, but I just look back and some different partying, different things on a college campus.
Sure, yeah.
You know, stuff like that, that you're like, man, looking back, I wish I would have did it. But as God doesn't make mistakes, right? I think one of my biggest wake-up calls ever was when I was in college and I made the relationship I had with a girlfriend number one. That was it. That was what I was trying to do. And when that fell apart, when you put all your eggs in an earthly basket, so to speak, and that happens, what do you turn to? So that was like God's way of saying, hey, get your priorities in order, mister. So that moment was one of my lowest at the time. I look back as one of my best moments because then when you talk about actual marriage with Lindsay and myself, we're able to put Christ first and we're able to chase him together. And it's just a moment that sounds cliche, but you're thankful it happened because it was a wake-up call.
Yeah. Okay. One last question before we move on to the book. Your father had MS and died early. Right? Mm-hmm. That can't not have an impact on you. If you don't mind, share a little bit about how that impacted you growing up.
Oh, man, Mike, I'm so glad you asked this. I'll tell you this. The hardest thing in writing a book, in my opinion, is you have to write a couple things that could hurt people. The last thing I would ever want to do by any means is to hurt my grandmother or tarnish my father's name at any point. My father was revered. People really liked him. And I'll say this. I don't have a single memory in my life of him mistreating me. Mm-hmm. What I didn't know, Mike, growing up, is he suffered from depression as a result of MS.
Yeah.
But I never knew this. And maybe I'm just a naive high school kid or whatever. He seemed to have a great attitude about his MS. And for those who don't know, MS is this disease that just deteriorates your body over time. I looked at a picture last night, Mike, from 2006, my high school graduation, and he is standing up. I remember at the time he used a cane, and he died 6 years later in 2012. And yeah. In those 6 years, I watched him go from a cane to a walker to a wheelchair to a scooter to a chair. Basically, he didn't have use of his legs. And
yeah,
I never heard him complain to me when we're out in public and I'd put him in the car, you'd have to lift his legs in. But he never made you seem like he was ashamed. So I never knew he was going through this depression. And he went to a doctor's office one time and they asked him, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, how depressed are you? And he answered a 10. And my oldest brother shared that with me. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I never knew that. So
wow.
What I shared in the book, Mike, and this was really hard for me to do, because I was the youngest by 7 or 8 years. So eventually my brothers go off to college. And they're living in other cities, and I'm at home. My father took out a lot of his frustration and anger and feelings on my mother. And I was there for that, and I lived through that. And again, I'm not playing a violin. So many people have a rougher story, but I did see him take out his frustrations on her. And it was so hard, Mike, because I'd walk in a room and he would glow like a light bulb and, hey, Levi, how are you, man? Just this, how he was around everyone. And from the stories I hear, how he was before his MS, you know, at his wake, the line was out the door. You're supposed to have a little break before the first session and second. We didn't. It just kept going and kept going and everyone coming to pay their respects. And I hear so many good stories. But I did see him deal with this depression, and I had to write that in the book. I write about my mom being this positive person, and I think that's amazing because she did have to live with a lot of things. And Mike, I don't pretend to understand what it feels like to have MS. So I'm not saying it was not warranted or warranted. I'm just saying I saw it. And I tell the students and kids I coach all the time, I remember coming home from a football practice, and I was a sophomore or whatever, and I just complained, you know, that my legs were sore and tired or whatever, and him looking up at me from his chair and just saying, I wish I could run. I wish I could do that.
And he was an athlete, if I remember correctly.
Yeah,
right?
he was playing baseball at Ohio University, or at least trying out for the team. He was a pretty successful athlete. So I did see that. And there were some things that his MS taught me and shaped me a little bit. There were things I had to do for my dad. And I wouldn't change that for a million, but just other kids my age didn't have to. I think you grow up a little bit earlier in that sense. I'm very aware of handicap accessible places and what some places are doing to make things accessible for those in wheelchairs and whatnot. But I love my dad. I'm my dad's son. It was hard writing that, hey, he was depressed, because some people like me may not have known that.
But that's part of your story. That's part of what our parents impact us in all sorts of ways, positively and negatively. And part of it is taking an honest inventory of that so that we can heal ourselves from what we need to heal from and grow and learn from there. So I appreciate you sharing that, Levi. I appreciate that.
How was your mom able to stay so positive, do you think, Levi? I mean, because you said that she never seemed to be negative. She never seemed to complain. And as you said, she was doing multiple jobs. A lot of this workload around the home probably fell on her, just because your dad wanted to take care of stuff, but he was just increasingly unable to. And yet she never seemed to complain. How do you think she was able to do that?
I don't know. I don't know, but I do watch it now, her and my children, her as grandma. She's just very unique. And I'm sure she did a lot of praying, but yeah, she never complained to any of us. And I think I did hear her say one time, Chris, that because a lot of times early on, my father didn't want to travel at all. Number one, just being out in public, I'm not sure how he felt about that. I can't imagine it was easy. But I know it got to a point with his depression that it was just like, no, I'm staying here. I'm going to be at my house. And I think that hurt my mom for a while because she wanted to go out and do all these things. She was still young. And I think she made the decision, she said at one time, that, hey, this is going on, but I'm still going to do things, especially with my kid. So again, my older brothers went off to college, but I went everywhere with my mom mm-hmm. growing up. Went on different vacations, just me and mom, that kind of thing. So I think at one point she did make the decision, right or wrong, to say, hey, I'm still going to do the things that I feel like I should do. Mm-hmm. But I'll say this, Chris. You've given me something to think about as far as I need to ask my mom that question, right? Yesterday would have been my dad's birthday, and I wrote a small post, but I said, hey, mm-hmm. if your parents are around, go have a real conversation with them. I read a book one time by Jeffrey Marks and Joe Ehrman's. It's called Season of Life. It's a tremendous book. But in that book, Jeffrey Marks talks about the relationship that I have with my dad is based on, hey, how'd the Pirates do last night? Did the Guardians win or lose? Oh, did you see this? So it was very surface-based. And he said, set an hour aside and talk to your dad about things you don't know the answer to. Mm-hmm. Ask him about the girl he dated before he dated your mom. Ask him those questions that you've never heard him say. And I remember doing that once after this advice. I said, okay, I'm going to have a conversation with dad. And I wish, oh, do I wish I would have recorded it or wrote it down. But my one memory from that, he said when he was in the hospital, he already had MS and he was now diagnosed with cancer. Mm-hmm. He has three young children. So I'm putting myself in that position. You're in the hospital. You have cancer. You have MS. You have three young children and a wife. Can't even imagine psychologically what you're going through. And he said he remembered at one point doing whatever and falling out of the bed onto the floor and cried out to God. And he said, please just take my fear away, because I don't think he was scared of what he was going through. I think he was scared of, I'm going to leave three kids. I think he was scared for his family. Mm. And he shared with me that after that moment, he never was scared again about his cancer. And that, to me, it gives me goosebumps. But I remember that moment. And it was so cool because I never would have asked him that question if I hadn't read that book by Jeffrey Marks. And I did a similar exercise with my grandma. And she told me that she made guns during World War II in a factory in Pittsburgh. And I'm like, whoa, what? Like, you're... what are you talking about? Oh, and she's like, yeah, when the war happened, I moved to Pittsburgh and I made guns and a fact. And I was just like, wow. So to anyone listening, if you've stayed on this long, I appreciate it. But if your parents are living, ask them questions. And I need to ask that to my mom, Chris. So thanks for the motivation.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think at some point in our adult lives, we have to recognize that our parents, even though they're always our parents, they're adults just like us. And they've been through stuff. And I think most parents don't share with their kids what they've been through. So yeah, I think it's a really good practice, Levi, to like you said, talk to your parents and just ask them what it was like to be them, what they went through and how they got through it. I think what you'll find a lot of times is some very stirring stories of how God brought them through difficult times. I won't go into detail, but my mom battled an autoimmune condition for 41 years that finally took her life. Yeah. Never complained, poured herself into other people. And I didn't have a lot of conversations with her about it because I just assumed she was my mom. That's just the way my mom was. But I did learn eventually that her faith is what pulled her through. She never talked about her faith. She just lived it.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you don't have these conversations with your parents, you never open the door and go in and find out what it was like to be them and how, like I said, in many cases, God brought them through. I don't know how you get through some of the stuff without God. I really don't. I don't know how you get through MS. I don't know how you get through autoimmune. I don't know how you get through depression. If you don't have God, I don't know how you make it. But fortunately, my mom and my dad had a faith that pulled them through some pretty tough stuff.
Man, well, thank you, Levi, for your transparency with that, brother.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. And I think just guys hearing that will mean a lot to them. I know it means a lot to us. So let's move on to your book. I can't believe, by the way, when I did the introduction, I don't think I mentioned the book. I'm such a goofball. You had to do it. So anyway, it's called Lead, A Coach's Playbook on How to Positively Impact the World Through Love, Effort, Attitude, and Discipline. And I love, can I just say this? I love how you organize the book by quarters as if it's like a football game.
Yeah, dude, absolutely.
So good. So good. Yeah. So first quarter is the introduction, and then you've got second, third, fourth quarter, and then you've got attitude, the winner's circle, and then discipline, and then you've got overtime at the end, which kind of the epilogue, I guess. Yeah. Dude, love it, love it. So if you would, give us kind of an overview of what you're trying to accomplish in the book, why you wrote it, and then we'll get into some more detailed questions.
Sure. So I wrote the book because I want to leave something behind for my kids when I die. I want them to say, hey, this is what Dad was trying to do. This is who he was. So that was like main motivation. I do think it will help anyone in a leadership position, especially if you are coaching. So the idea of the book, I was talking to a colleague of mine at the Positive Coaching Alliance. Her name is Pam Harith, and she's amazing. She does a lot of leadership and culture work. And when she talks about culture, she says, hey, you got to know what matters to you. You got to know why it matters. You got to look at the challenges you're going to face. And then essentially, what does it look like? Because in my opinion, I think that title, LEAD, L-E-A-D, Love, Effort, Attitude, Discipline, looks good on a bumper sticker. I think as a coach, if I show it to parents and say, hey, this is what we're going to do, they're going to say, oh yeah, that sounds great. And a lot of coaches do that, but they miss the practical part of this is how I'm going to try and foster love into our players. You've got a playbook for offense. You've got a playbook for defense. If you're in football, you've got a playbook for special teams. And I think such an error made by well-intended coaches, they say, oh, kids are going to learn about resiliency just by being on the team. Just by being here and around us, they're gonna figure out what discipline is, right? No, I don't think so, especially because not everyone on a football team is on the field at the same time. And not everyone plays the same number of minutes on a Friday night, or not everyone catches the touchdown or blocks for a touchdown or drops the pass to win the game. Not everyone has the same experience. So how do you design a practice to try and teach the character traits that are important to you? In the book, I say, hey, what's really important is to have a coaching philosophy. And I explain why I think that is so important. During my master's degree, our final project was to come up with your own coaching philosophy. So I'm working for Mike Duve, the same guy I talked about earlier, and I'm pumped. I have a 12-page document on all these coaches and what they're trying to do. And he gives it back to me, and he's like, dude, nobody's going to read this. Nobody's going to remember 12 pages. So he gives me another book by Pete Carroll. It's called Win Forever. It's a great book. And Pete Carroll says, hey, you've got 25 words or less. That's it. That's your coaching philosophy. And I had been a coach for a long time, and I never had this philosophy. And I always say that God gave me this philosophy. He did. It wasn't something I invented. He took me through this path and eventually revealed to me that what was really important to me is love, effort, attitude, and discipline based on how I was brought up, based on who I enjoyed watching coach, all those things. And I share in the book, I love this acronym because not only is it who I am and genuine to me, but also because it's based on biblical principles. So I share that in the book. Hey, as a public high school football coach, I'm never going to make you believe what I believe. I'm going to make my views known, and hopefully bring people to Christ. And I feel like we've done some really good stuff over the years with Fellowship of Christian Athletes and different things. But when you look through the Bible, there are so many examples of love, effort, attitude, and discipline. And I write about that in the book. Had an article published a few years by Sports Spectrum magazine. They have a podcast out, but Christ said the greatest commandment of all is to love God with all of your heart, all of your soul, all of your might, and to love others as yourself. That's the greatest commandment. So for me, love comes first. Heck yeah, it comes first. And then you look at the middle things of what do we control? We don't control the weather and the officials and all those things, but we do control our effort and our attitude. And that's so hard. We talked about that earlier, Chris. You don't control the event, but you do control your response to the event. And just looking through the Bible, it says, don't be afraid, be strong and courageous. And it says, dwell on these things. And whatever you do in your life, work for it as if you're working for Christ, like if you're working for God. That's Colossians 3:23. That's my license plate. And then I think about Lombardi and Lou Holtz and all these disciplinarians as a coach. Lou Holtz, he brings up Hebrews of like, hey, no discipline seems pleasant at the time, but in the end, it works out and God's going to discipline his own children for good. So I share how these align with my faith. And then lastly, I say, these things are also proven to work through sports psychology. So went for my doctorate in sports psychology, learned about this organization called the Positive Coaching Alliance that I've been working for a number of years. It's my favorite work that I get to do is train coaches, athletes, parents through the Positive Coaching Alliance on this thing that's called positive psychology. It's an actual science-based form of psychology that's proven to be the best form of coaching. So I get into that a little bit in the book. And then I share, I'm passionate about LEAD. Here's how we did it in practice, as far as this is how we tried to coach love and effort, attitude, discipline. So I feel like if a coach read this book, they might see some things in that chapter. I think that's the third or fourth quarter of the playbook, but they might say, oh, that's a really cool thing that he did there. Because Mike, Chris, as you know, coaches, we just take things from other people. We say, oh, I like what he's doing. I like what she's doing. We're going to do that. We're going to start doing that. And some things work and you continue to do them or you put your own spin on it. Some things you say, oh, that just doesn't work in this particular situation. But that's the book. I wrote it to leave something behind. And I feel like, hey, I've been a coach for 14 years, have a doctorate, a couple master's degrees. If a young coach puts down $20 and he's able to get everything I've learned in that time, then that's a pretty good deal for that coach.
I like how you talked about games as well as practice, you know, that you've got to bring the effort, you got to bring the attitude in games. But let's face it, in most sports, you spend a heck of a lot more time on the practice field. And, you know, some players, like you said, some players don't get into the game a lot. But when they're in, all that practice time, all that discipline, all that attitude has to show itself in that limited time that they're on the field. And I think there's a lot of translations to life there. We spend a lot of time on the practice field, but when we get in the game, when we have that moment, all that work that we've put in has to come to fruition. So I really like your model, and I like pretty much everything you said. And I'm a coach too, so I see a lot of parallels between coaching, especially in sports, and quote real life. But,
Well, the definition of a coach in the old days was a vehicle to get you from point A to point B, right?
Right.
That's why
we
use the term coach. So I call everybody coach, and that's kind of like the old thing. Hey, how you doing, coach? How you doing, coach? But it's true. You don't have to wear the hat and the whistle around your neck to be a coach. If you're a mom and you're raising kids, you are coaching your kids. You are getting them from where they are to where they need to be. And I don't just mean a transportation type thing. So I think one thing that's hard for coaches is this idea of time. I don't have time to do this. It sounds great. And what I'm trying to say, kind of like what you said, Chris, is this isn't something you should be adding to how you coach. It's how you should coach.
Right.
And coaches say, okay, I've only got 2 hours and I need to practice offense, defense, and dribbling and doing all this stuff. Well, I say, okay, for us, on the top of our practice plan every Monday had the word love. And it said, how am I going to foster love into my coaching today? And Monday's theme for the coaching staff was love. And Tuesday was effort. And Wednesday was attitude. And Thursday was discipline. And Friday, we'd bring it together with lead. But you're right. In high school football, especially here in Wisconsin, we have 9 games. 9. And you
wow.
lift weights.
That's it?
You lift weights all year round. You practice in July. You have all kinds of practice in August. And then throughout the school year, it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday, you practice for 1 game. So let's focus on how we create this environment. Because for whoever's listening, the team you coach, your family, the place you go to work, there is a culture there. There's a culture. It could be a good culture. It could be a bad culture. But there is a feeling. There is an environment. There is a way things are done. And you have the ability to change that. But you have to be proactive in how you do it. So a good exercise is just to close your eyes and you're at your workplace, you're at the team you're coaching or whatever, but what do you want it to look like? What do you want it to sound like? What do you want to see people doing? I saw a thing last year with the Green Bay Packers, and a lot of teams probably do this, but the veterans were given a rookie special handshake or whatever. It's like, how cool would that be if every veteran, every senior on the football team had a special handshake with the new people? But that's the kind of thing as a coach you have to share and make known. As they say, sports don't build character, they reveal character. So when you get in the moment, how does that work?
Ooh, that was poignant. I love that. When I played, and I'm hopefully going to take myself off the pedestal for you. I know you still worship me as an athlete. That's okay. But really, here's what's interesting, and I want to get your feedback on this, okay? And maybe you can bring in some elements or principles from your book. So the way I would describe my playing days in high school was I played scared. And what I mean by that is I played, number one, not wanting to make a mistake, and number two, not wanting to get hurt. And it really impacted me. And there were other times later on, I had an opportunity in my mid-20s when I was coaching football in Chicago, and I got to jump in and just be a DB with some of the guys. And I played balls to the wall. Yeah. I was absolutely cut loose, played so fearless because the stakes weren't as high, of course. And I was actually there because I was playing with the freshman B team against the freshman A team, or I'm sorry, it was a JV or something. But I'm trying to help the B team do well. And it was night and day, the way things, the ball would always bounce my way. All sorts of different things played to my advantage when I was playing not scared. And it made me wish, man, I wish I would have played differently, fearlessly when I was in high school.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, what would you, a player or even a coach who might feel that way, or just a guy who lives life out of fear?
Love
to hear your thoughts.
I think, and why I'm so passionate about coaching education, is a lot of people coach the way they were coached. That's how they start coaching. And unfortunately, we have some old school coaches in the 60s, 70s, or whatever, who coached out of fear. That's just the way they did. And people start coaching again. They think they have to yell and scream and belittle people and put this fear into them, because if you don't do it, somebody else will. And that's very hard. So one thing I share in the book, if we want to get the best effort out of people, it starts with how we speak. I call it effort terminology, or however you want to do it. How do you define success? How do you define failure? We talk about a growth mindset. That's a huge buzzword in education right now. Carol Dweck wrote this book called Mindset, and they should hand it out in the delivery room. It is that good. Speaking about how you coach effort into people, and that, hey, mistakes are not fatal. We're not in the military here. We're playing sport. And we're probably going to get a chance to do this next week or maybe even the same day. You talk about baseball, the sport of failure. You fail 7 out of 10 times, you're in the Hall of Fame. Look on the scoreboard. There's a spot for error. It's not if it happens, it's when it happens. So this organization I work with called the Positive Coaching Alliance, I love what they do. And I talk about this in the book. They have a thing called the mistake ritual. So, Mike, you're out on the field, and I know this never happened, but you dropped a pass in a varsity football game. You caught everything, yeah. I know, so this is a far-fetched story, but you dropped a pass.
I know. It's a stretch, but I'm trying to relate.
It's a hypothetical. It's a hypothetical.
Yeah, right.
Clearly hypothetical. So, I've been on the headset before, and I hear coaches say, he dropped the ball. And by the way, Mike, you probably know you dropped the ball, right? And everyone in the stands saw you drop the ball. So what we would say at the Positive Coaching Alliance is get to know your athlete and create something called a mistake ritual. One that they use a lot is flush it. So when you dropped that fiction pass, you turn around, you look at me, and I say, Mike, hey, flush it, man, flush it. And you look back at me, and you have to do the physical thing to flush it. Flush it. And then you're able to focus on the next play because said, oh, the coach knows I messed up. I'm acknowledging I messed up. Now I can focus because our minds are great time travelers. They like to go in the past and think of these mistakes. I love the story. Alex Rodriguez, before he signed with the Yankees, he's coming off an MVP season for the Mariners. He hit like 358, all these home runs. They said, Alex, what is your goal for the upcoming season? And they were thinking he was going to say MVP, World Series, whatever. And he said, I want to play one game in the present. Whoo, right?
Wow.
So in the book, I talk about like this mistake ritual is a great way to get your athletes from fearing failure. Yeah. I've done this with athletes before. I had a 10-year-old quarterback. I'll never forget him. But he was doing, and I'm like, what are you doing, man? He's like, you got to learn it and burn it. You got to learn it and burn it. I'm like, all right, Braxton, all right. So anytime he'd look at me and just do that. That was our thing, right? It was our thing to say, we messed up. We're going to move on to the next play. But then, unfortunately, you know, I wrote about not only my best coach and my mom, but I wrote about who I perceived to be my worst coach. And he coached out of fear. And saw a lot of athletes just shut down over the years. A lot of athletes in my mind may not have even come out for the team because they did not want to be yelled and screamed at and belittled. I think that's why coaching education is so important to me, is just to be able to talk about those things. But it's also why the field of mental performance, Mike and Chris, is so popular, because a lot of high school coaches are not trained in how to do these things. So I try to share some tips through my doctorate and master's and different things, as here's some science behind the mistake ritual, and here's some science behind coaching positive and why it works and how you should do it.
That's great, man. That's great. I appreciate that, because I think for men, there's so much pressure that we face every day, trying just not to make mistakes, and whether it be in our marriage, our parenting, or where we work, in our career. And to have that mentality, or even what you're pointing to there to me too, is that as men, we need to have other men in our lives who can remind us of what you just reminded us of. Someone to say, hey, you messed up. Flush it.
Yeah.
Flush it. Let's go. Let's move on. Knock the dust off. Let's go. And unfortunately, I think it's the guys who don't have those other men in their lives to help remind them of that that end up, unfortunately, struggling more than not. So that's great. That's a great reminder. All right, Levi. I want to do one more thing.
I was going to say, go out and grab a book. The easiest way, just go on Amazon and type in my name, Levi Nelson, and the book should pop up. That's the easiest way.
Are you on social media anywhere
I'm
people
also
can follow you?
I'm on Twitter. I post a lot on Twitter at R Levi Nelson, and you'll see it's me. I've got my hands up. I'm coaching. I'm doing that.
Yeah.
So I use Twitter at R Levi Nelson, and then just go on Amazon, type in Levi Nelson to find the book. Would so much appreciate any support. When I was writing it, I had some advice to write it a different way, because they said it kind of looks like a Bible study when you're going through it. You've got questions, but that's how I wanted it. I wanted there to be some reflection as you go through. So I think it would be good for any men's group or if you're on a coaching staff or even with your close friends. So would appreciate any support. And if you have any questions, please reach out and I'd love to connect.
I know we got to let you go, but I would love to pray for you, man, before we do that. Let me pray. God, thank you so much for Levi. I praise you, Father, for who you've created him to be, Lord, who you fashioned him and molded him over the years to be, God. I thank you for his mother and his father. God, I know they hold a special place in my heart, Lord. Just beautiful, amazing people. And I'm just grateful for all the positive ways, Lord, you've used them in Levi's life. We thank you for his brothers, Luke and Andy, and God, the ways that you've used them to influence him as well. And now, God, Levi is living for others and helping to build others up, coach others, encourage others, God. And so I pray that you protect him, protect his family, his marriage, God, and provide for their every need as he seeks to serve you and your kingdom. Lord, we lift him up to you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Thank you, Levi.
Thanks, boys. Thanks, Levi.